This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Over the past few years, we've become accustomed to hear the United States described as the sole superpower, a global hegemon, uniquely able to project military force anywhere in the world. Though they disagree on what to do about it, both right and left increasingly accept the notion of an American empire. In his new book, Joseph Nye asks us to think again. Military power is very important, he says, but hardly the only measure of national power. In addition to military force and economic strength, there is a third level of power, a level of principles, values, culture, and policies, and he argues that many times this soft power can achieve national aims at a far lower cost than either carrots or sticks. Far too often, he says, soft power is ignored by policymakers. As one example, he cites Iraq, where a brilliant triumph of American hard power was undermined by policies many around the world perceived as unilateral, arrogant, imperial. If you have questions about the definition and the uses of power, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll talk about some cases in point. Joseph Nye joins us here in Studio 3A. He's the dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. His new book is Soft Power, The Means to Success in World Politics. And welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be with you again.
You structure your book and this idea of power around a pretty interesting visual model, a 3D chessboard. Explain it, if you will.
Well, if you look at power, which is the ability to get the outcomes you want, it varies tremendously in different dimensions. In the military area, which we'll call at the top level of a three-dimensional chessboard, the United States is the only superpower. Nobody's going to catch us militarily for quite some time. But if you look at the middle board, which is the economic issues between countries, there's a balance of power. The United States not alone. We can't get what we want without the agreement of the European Commission or the Japanese or Chinese. If you go to the bottom level of this 3D chessboard, the level of transnational relations that cross borders outside the control of government, everything from the spread of infectious diseases to transnational terrorism, nobody's in charge. It makes no sense to call that American hegemony or American empire. The only way you can solve these kinds of problems is by getting others to cooperate with us. The trouble I see is that we spend so much time noticing how strong we are on the top board that we forget that we have to deal with the new threats, which are coming from the bottom board.
And these boards are not simply three separate planes. They interact vertically.
That's right. And Iraq is an interesting example. On the top board of hard military power in the Iraq War, we did brilliantly. But at the same time, according to various intelligence reports, we increased the ability of al-Qaeda, our sworn enemy, to recruit in the Islamic world on the bottom board. So if you balance that up, a gain on the top board, but a loss on the bottom board.
And we'll have to see whether it's a net gain at the end of the day.
Too soon to tell, but since al-Qaeda are the ones that hit us on 9/11, it's not a promising start.
Does power always break down into one of these neat categories?
No, but power is very much dependent upon the context. I mean, we think of various resources that produce power, but when the context changes, they change. Tanks are great hard power resource in a desert. They're not much good in a swamp. Or to think of it historically, uranium was a power resource after the nuclear age. Before that, it was just a nuisance.
And similarly, economic power, sanctions might be useful against in a situation like South Africa, for instance, during apartheid, but less successful, obviously, against a transnational foe like al-Qaeda.
That's right. And even against countries, we find that economic sanctions only have worked in somewhere between a third to a half of the cases where they've been tried. So it's easy to see your results usually with military power. You either win or lose a battle fairly quickly, though there are exceptions to that. It took a long time to lose the Vietnam War, a decade. But generally speaking, you see the results much more quickly. Economic power, somewhat in between. Soft power often takes quite some time.
You point out a case of human rights policies in the Carter administration in your book that you say had some unusual echoes some years afterwards.
That's right. I remember going to Buenos Aires with Secretary of State Cyrus Vance when I was in the Carter administration, and the United States was very unpopular for beating up on the Argentine government about human rights. But when I went back in 1991 as a visitor, the United States was wildly popular, and the reason is because the people who were having their fingernails torn out in the 1970s when we were complaining about it were in power in the 1990s. And that actually helped us when we were trying to get support in the UN and for going into the Balkans to deal with the disturbances there. And the Argentines were very supportive.
Mm-hmm. So that that element of soft power in the Carter administration, obviously,
that's right, paid off a couple of decades later.
For the Clinton administration, decades later. Nevertheless, Jimmy Carter's human rights policies may have been a success in soft power. He had some other difficulties with hard power, as you point out. If you fail, as President Carter's and American forces did at Desert One, trying to intervene in Iran, that can cost you prestige and loss of hard power as well.
Absolutely, it's not a question of hard power versus soft. Power. The two are complementary, and my complaint is with those who think that hard power alone is sufficient, but very often soft power alone is not sufficient either. The question is, how do you combine the two so that you're a smart power?
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join our conversation, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. Our address is totn@npr.org. And our guest is Joe Nye. His new book is Soft Power, The Means to Success in World Politics. And let's begin with Moji. And Moji joins us on the phone from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi. I want to make the basic point that power... We don't have soft or hard power. We have power. The only difference is that when power is divorced from morality, from justice, then it becomes the law of the jungle. And that's the basic thing. I mean, all the other, with all due respect to your guest, mm-hmm. very fine analysis of modes of practicing power. But we're dealing with power itself. And power, whether it is disguised or whether it is finessed into public relations and PR, doesn't matter. When power is applied, it needs to be applied. It needs to be not applied. It needs to have in itself, in its own nature, a very, very connected for empowerment, a very, very deeply interconnected relationship with justice and with morality. And when it is, as in the specifically in the case of the so-called war on terrorism and the so-called war in Iraq, when power is applied nakedly without any relationship to real morality and real justice, then it becomes the law of the jungle.
Do you see, Moji, that the United States applied military power in Afghanistan to attack the Taliban and al-Qaeda without justice, without morality?
Well, yes, in the sense that the Taliban was put in power by the U.S. and also the Ba'ath Party, going back to after the beginning of the Hassan al-Bakr rule, it was the CIA that put Saddam Hussein in power. So we can't, we can't have it both ways.
Well, we're going to have some disagreement, I suspect, on the facts. But what about Moji's point, Joseph?
Well, the basic point, that's power is the ability to get others to do the things you want. And it can be used for good or bad purposes. Bad people can have soft power. For example, bin Laden has soft power among a number of extreme Muslims. If you look at the recent Pew polls, you find that more people trust bin Laden in Pakistan and in Jordan than trust the United States. So you can have power. Soft power is not good or bad. It's just a form of power, and it can be used for good purposes or bad purposes.
So morality is not an element of it?
Well, morality, if you have a moral cause, you're more likely to attract others, and that's likely to enhance your soft power. So if you look at, for example, Gandhi was very effective tactically in getting what he wanted, getting the British out of India, because he not only used soft power instead of hard power, but that was seen as moral. Same thing with Martin Luther King in the United States. Indeed, sometimes it's interesting to play historically with the fact that if Yasser Arafat had chosen the soft power approach of Gandhi rather than the hard power of guerrilla warfare, I'll bet there'd be a Palestinian state now.
Hmm. Is legitimacy an element of power?
Absolutely. People follow others when they think that they're legitimate, when they're attractive. And if your policies are seen as legitimate by others, you're more likely to attract others.
Can hard power itself generate soft power if you're seen as invincible?
Stalin and Hitler both tried that, by having a myth of invincibility to become attractive to others, and that can be a source of soft power. Though it's worth noticing historically that the Soviet Union had a lot of soft power after World War II. They were the opponents of fascism during the war. Communism was actually quite popular in Europe, particularly France and Italy, after World War II. But the Soviets squandered that soft power by the way they used their hard power to invade Hungary and Czechoslovakia. So their hard power continued to grow, but the way they used it made their soft power decline.
Let's get another caller in. Ken joins us on the line from Cleveland.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, interesting concept. I was just wondering yesterday with, our current war on Iraq and bad press we've been getting throughout, Muslim nations, that would seem like it would decrease our soft power and actually make it harder for our, U.S. intelligence agencies to, make friends with people and collect human intelligence. Wouldn't it, be harmful, for the country as a whole, depending on, which kind of power we used?
I think that's exactly right. If you take Indonesia, which is the largest Islamic country in the world, in 2000, a poll showed that 3/4 of Indonesians had a favorable view of the U.S. After the Iraq War, that declined to 15%, 1/5. That's an extraordinary drop. Well, we need the cooperation of Indonesians to deal with the Jamaah Islamiyah and other offshoots of Al-Qaeda. To some extent, they'll cooperate with us out of their own self-interest, but the degree of cooperation has a lot to do with how attractive or unattractive we are.
Okay. Ken, thanks very, very much.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And I wanted to ask you, because of these different levels of power that you talk about, and economic level, again, where there are more than one node, the United States may have the largest economy, but the Europeans, the Chinese, the Japanese, the Russians all certainly have a voice in all of that, and this bottom, more chaotic level of soft power, you say that this makes nonsense of the idea of an American empire.
Well, it doesn't make much sense to talk of an American empire when you can't control things. I mean, the whole idea of empire is that you have control, but we really don't have control. This is a country that couldn't even get the votes of Canada, Mexico, and Chile last year when we were asking for their votes in the UN before we went into Iraq. That's hard to call that an empire.
So if it's necessary to balance all of these different elements of power in terms of who's wielding it, the people at the top, have we gotten out of balance, do you think?
I think we're out of balance. I think what happened is when the Cold War ended, the American people wanted a peace dividend. We cut back enormously on what we spent on international exchange programs, on broadcasting, on things that developed.
Voice of America, that
Voice
sort
of America, exactly. And that happened right after the Cold War in the Clinton administration. But then when the Bush administration came in, they not only didn't restore that those cuts, but they also had a rather unilateralist, some would say arrogant policy, which again made us unpopular. The net result is that the combination of policy and investments, we're not as popular as we used to be. Now, people say popularity is ephemeral, it doesn't matter. But let me tell you, when you become so unpopular that you're the kiss of death in the domestic politics of another country, it can hurt you.
We're talking with Joe Nye about his new book, Soft Power. And when we come back from a short break, we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address again, TOTN@NPR.org. We'll be talking more about the definition of soft power and talking about some cases in point, Pakistan, North Korea. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest is Joe Nye, Dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, author of the new book, Soft Power, formerly Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration. If you have a question about soft power or hard power, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get another listener on the phone. This is Angela, who's with us from Corvallis, Oregon.
Good morning. I was thinking about this in a historical perspective. It seems that this problem, the dilemma between hard and soft power, has existed ever since, you know, we've taken sharpened sticks and hit each other. So what is it that motivates a person to choose between intelligence and covert actions, et cetera, to, you know, shock and awe? Why is there a choice of the two, and why do people choose it?
Well, it's a great question. You know, Machiavelli had the view in the Italian city-states that a prince was, if he had to choose between being loved and being feared, it would be better to be feared than loved. But obviously, it's still better yet if you can be both feared and loved. So this question of how you combine hard and soft power is, as you pointed out, an age-old dilemma. But it also is a tactical question. I mean, think about the example of Gandhi and India. He knew that he could never raise a force which would beat the British, but he could appeal to the consciences of the majority of Britons who were moderates and shame them into change, as Martin Luther King shamed people into change in the United States. So sometimes the tactical choice, which may be driven by a person's internal moral compass, also turns out to be a very practical choice.
It may be driven by the nature of the occupier as well. If there
right.
was Nazi Germany, perhaps resistance of that type might not have worked.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why you probably could not have used soft power to unseat the Taliban government. I mean, there are times when you have to use hard power.
If internal moral compass is so variable, then is that really something we should be basing this on? How about just something simple like international unity? Something, keep it simple.
Well, I think that's a nice principle, but take that example of the Taliban government in Afghanistan. We tried for years to persuade them to stop giving a base to Al-Qaeda, but to no avail. I think we did have to use hard power after September 11th to dislodge the Taliban and to prevent Al-Qaeda from having a terrorist haven.
Angela, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Bye. Here's an email question we have from J. Michael Short. Isn't the Vietnam conflict a prime example of a situation where American military power failed against another type of culturally embedded power?
Well, that's correct. I mean, the United States tried with military power to defeat nationalist appeals in Vietnam, and it failed. We could not overcome the strength of the North Vietnamese soft power. And in that sense, it was a defeat for us. We also lost a good deal of our attractiveness outside the country as a result of those efforts. Remember, we had great campaigns to win hearts and minds in Vietnam, but they didn't work.
Yet some people would say, point to the ephemeral nature of soft power and say, all right, maybe Vietnam was a disaster for American soft power, but the United States won that back in spades.
That's true. We recovered from our loss of attractiveness after Vietnam, but notice we also changed our policy. No more Vietnam. And we did a lot of other things that were attractive to people. So, yes, we can recover our soft power. Indeed, we have to hope so, because the current polls that show that we've lost a tremendous amount of attractiveness, we've got to hope that we can win it back.
Let's go now to Larry. He's with us from Stoneham, Massachusetts.
Yes. I wanted the comment of the author on the situation of the Roman Empire, whether that was an example of a mix of hard power and soft power.
It certainly was. I mean, the Romans conquered by their hard power, but then they integrated people into becoming parts of a Roman status. And in that sense, the feeling that one could become a Roman citizen was an important dimension of Roman soft power. The French did it also in the French Empire in the 19th century, where they conquered, for example, West Africa, but a poet like Leopold Senghor from Senegal was a member of the French Parliament and was widely celebrated as a French author. So yes, empires can have soft power, if they're clever about it.
Larry, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. I wanted to get to some more contemporary examples, if we could. You take Pakistan, for example, and you write, President Pervez Musharraf faces a complex game of cooperating with the United States in the war on terrorism while managing a large anti-American constituency at home. He winds up balancing concessions and retractions. If the United States were more attractive to the Pakistani populace, we would see more concessions in the mix.
That's right. If you take a situation like Pakistan, a political leader like Musharraf has to keep his fundamentalists from getting out of control. He has to make sure that he's not too far away from public opinion. And yet at the same time, he wants to make concessions or be helpful to the Americans. And it's a tightrope that he's walking. And how well he walks that tightrope, which side he tends to lean toward, depends very much on whether we're attractive or not.
Yet you also say policies are important element of American soft power. Musharraf overthrew an elected government. He's a military dictator. Isn't support of military dictators, isn't that policy undermine your policy of spreading democracy?
It does, and many people in Pakistan argue that because we're working with a general who overthrew an elected government, that makes our claims to be promoting democracy and human rights somewhat hypocritical. We're stuck in the case of Pakistan with a short-term, long-term dilemma. In the short term, we very much need to work with Musharraf to make sure we defeat al-Qaeda and bin Laden. In the long term, though, we should be working toward creating the conditions in Pakistan, better education, better economic growth, more openness in trade, and so forth, which would gradually underpin democracy.
Yet by at the same time, President Musharraf walks that fine line. One of the things he does is allow the continuation of the madrasas that many people believe have produced many of the al-Qaeda members.
That's absolutely true. And one of the things we try to do then is to
put
pressure on him to open up the educational curriculum in the madrasas. And he says to us, yes, but then how much it actually happens depends on how popular or unpopular we look inside Pakistan.
As you look at the limits and possibilities of soft power, how do you analyze the situation in North Korea, where you have a regime that fundamentally rejects a lot of American values?
Yeah, it's pretty hard to see soft power having much impact in North Korea. Kim Jong-il is a remnant of the Stalinist-era dictators. And it's not clear that he's going to be attracted by American values or American policies. I think that's a case where we have to organize a coalition of other countries, including Chinese, South Koreans, Japanese, to present him with a choice between giving up his nuclear program and getting resources which may save his economy or watching his economy go bankrupt.
Presented with an ideology that rejected Western values in the Cold War, one of the things the United States and its allies did extremely well was to work on the sentiments of the people. That's going to be more difficult in North Korea.
Absolutely. It's hard to get access to them. On the other hand, it's interesting, in the Cold War, the Soviets were very reluctant to give us access in any significant amount, but some of the people who first came in exchange programs back in 1958 included those who 25 years later helped Mikhail Gorbachev install perestroika and glasnost, which led to the unraveling of the Soviet Union. So they imbibed American ideas, even though there were only about 50 of them at the time, but they were undercover until 25 years later, but then had a powerful impact.
And to go on to the situation regarding al-Qaeda, you mentioned the Taliban. Similarly with al-Qaeda, this is an organization whose very ethos would reject all of those soft power components of the United States. How does soft power work into that equation?
Well, with al-Qaeda, you can't attract them. They're bitterly opposed to the U.S. You've got to use hard power against them. Where soft power matters there is to prevent them from recruiting from the moderate majority. In other words, we have to attract the moderates so that the al-Qaeda radicals can't recruit more to their cause. And if we're unattractive among the moderates, their recruiting is going to go up.
So you've described the situation in the world today as not so much a clash of civilizations, if you will, but the aspect you're discussing is a sort of internal war in the Arab and Muslim world between extremists and moderates.
That's right. It's a clash within Islamic civilization between a radical group who wants to use force to push people back to what they see as a purer form of their religion, and a more moderate group that wants things like jobs and education for their children and better health care and dignity. And we've got to make sure we frame policies which deal with the latter, that attract the latter, so that the radicals can't attract them.
Let's go now on the phone to Brent, who's with us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hi. You know, you may have just addressed part of my question, but I guess what I was concerned about and what I've been thinking about a lot, I'm a high school history teacher, so we discuss this a lot in class. In terms of geopolitical concerns, we seem to, over and over, for short-term benefit for our foreign policy, get aligned with those who then turn around and end up fighting against us. I mean, brief examples are the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and, you know, Iraq in the early 80s, and then now with Pakistan, with the Musharraf and the Pakistani people not liking us very much. How do we fix this problem of trying to ally ourselves short-term and then using soft power, finding a way to not have to use hard power in the long run?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I mean, foreign policy is constant game of trade-offs. We're trying to trade off our short-term and our long-term security interests. We're trying to trade off economic and security interests, human rights and security interests. And it's not easy. But what we need to do is, as we, let's say, deal with a situation in the short term to try to preserve our security, we've got to ask, how do we make that situation better so we don't face the same nasty trade-offs 5 and 10 years from now? And that goes back to what I said about the importance of doing things to open these countries' economies, to help them build better educational systems, to build a civil society, the things that become the bases for democracy over the longer term.
How do you feel we're going to be able to accomplish that with the Pakistanis?
Well, we've got to make sure, to give you a couple of practical examples, that we don't use protectionism at home to exclude Pakistani textiles from the United States. We've got to make sure that they get assistance not just for military equipment, but for a better educational system. Those are the types of things that we want to put into our mix.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Brent. As we look at the situation in Iraq, obviously the United States is involved at this point in another effort to win hearts and minds and produce real results for the Iraqi people. First of all, would you say that American soft power in the intermediate and near and intermediate range is going to be intimately tied up with how well it does in Iraq?
Absolutely. I mean, whatever one thinks about whether we should have gone into Iraq or not, or gone in the way we did, we're there. As Tom Friedman has said, we broke it, we own it. If we leave a mess behind, a failed state as a haven for terrorists, this will be a terrible black eye to the United States. We don't have any choice but to try to make things better in Iraq.
And on the tactical level, if you see situations like we've all seen today, I don't know if you've had a chance to see the television set, but the awful descriptions and accounts of what happened in Fallujah, where four Americans were killed, their bodies dragged through the streets, some of them hung from bridges. How would you advise somebody to go into a situation where ultimately you're trying to win hearts and minds, but nevertheless atrocities like that have to be addressed?
You have to have security before you can have anything else. I mean, people can't think about liberty or democracy when their lives are about to be taken. So we have to create security in the situation, and that requires hard power. But we also need to be spending a lot more effort on trying to attract others to a positive vision in which we're friends rather than imperial occupiers.
But how? When you have a mob dragging American bodies through the streets.
You can't do it with the mob. You have to do it with the people who are not in the mob, who you want to prevent from joining the mob. And that is where one of the striking things is how poor we've been at communicating inside Iraq. I mean, the radio and television that we set up after the war was really not worthy of a nation that's the great communicating nation that we are.
We're speaking with Joseph Nye. His new book is Soft Power, The Means to Success in World Politics. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go now to Gowrie, who's on the line with us from Portland, Oregon.
Yes. Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to make an observation followed by a question. We used hard power whenever we need a quick results. And the soft power is the one which is slow and steady, and also uncertainties about the outcome is always there. And also long years of soft power approach can easily be taken away by one wrong move. So in this situation, I want to ask this question. We used to hard power in Iraq now, and can ever this hard power usage be justified in future if Iraq returns to normalcy and be a peaceful nation like the rest of the world? Can this hard power be ever justified?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's hard to do the total balance sheet on the pluses and minuses of a war like Iraq without looking out a decade or so. In the short run, as I mentioned earlier, I think the minuses may be ahead of the pluses right now. The plus is that we got rid of a tyrant and opened up potential for the future. The minus is that we've created a great deal of new recruitment into the terrorist organizations throughout the Islamic world and lost a good deal of our attractiveness to others. But it's too early to judge. If 7 years from now or 10 years from now, Iraq looks like Germany or Japan, which we occupied after World War II, people may be able to say, well, see, it was worth using hard power because it did transform the region. That takes a degree of optimism to project that, but nonetheless, it can't draw up an honest balance sheet until you have a little bit more perspective than we have now.
Is this work, according to my observation, this is soft power. It can be the uncertainty of the outcome of a soft power usage is very unpredictable. You can be aiding a country to build, but one wrong move or one policy change will wipe off all the benefits that that country received. So is that why people or countries are reluctant in approaching soft power approach?
Well, if we are arrogant or do things which are profoundly offensive to others or don't take their interests into account, we can indeed destroy a good deal of our soft power.
Dowry, thanks very much for the question. Appreciate the phone call.
Okay.
I was going to ask a complicated question. I'm afraid we just don't have time for it. Joseph Nye, thank you so much for coming by today.
Thank you.
Wait a minute. I'm looking. I'm going to have time for that question.
Okay,
we're going to ask you to come back after the break. I apologize for that. So we are going to be back with Joseph Nye after the break. I just had a little mental lapse there. And if you've got additional questions, please call us, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can email us, TOTN, at npr.org, at least for the rest of today until they hear this tape. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News in Washington. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest is Joseph Nye. He's the author of a new book called Soft Power, The Means to Success in World Politics. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN at npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Susan, who's with us from Minneapolis.
Hello, my name is Susan, and with all due respect for the idea of soft power, I think the discussion is a little bogus because it does not take into account the humanitarian catastrophes that go along with hard power. And I mean large and small, landmines, bombings, whatever we do for the sake of good, as well as mistakenly or as miscreants of our great superpower, it is still much more damaging than whatever soft power engagements we take on. And I do have an example to give if you're interested in hearing.
If you could keep it very quick.
Well, all right. We talked about the people who had their fingernails removed in Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
We did not talk about the 11,000 disappeared. When the Argentine government was restructured using those torture victims as our basis of support, which later on was very useful to us in the Balkans, we did not talk about the fact that our aim may or may not have been social justice, but it was power. And it ended up being, even though it was apparently soft power, it ended up being hard power in the sense that we did not fight hard enough to keep those 11,000 people safe.
In Argentina?
Yes.
Yes. Joseph Nye?
Well, certainly Jimmy Carter did make efforts. He was often criticized at the time for placing too much emphasis on human rights, and that was as much for the people who were in jail being tortured as for those who were disappeared. So in that case, I think that you could argue that Carter did it because he thought it was a moral imperative to express American values through human rights policy, and it did pay off. It just didn't pay off in terms of soft power until a couple of decades later.
And as Susan points out, too late for those disappeared.
That's true.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good point, Susan. Thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And it raises the question I wanted to bring up before the break, and that is soft power without hard power. The European Union, mm-hmm. as you suggest, has quite substantial economic power and quite substantial soft power as well, yet lacks the hard power, certainly, that the United States has.
That's true. The Europeans have a good deal of soft power that results from their experience in creating a European Union and integration, pulling countries together. And you saw this with the desire of the Eastern European countries to join Europe. You see it today with the influence that Europe has on Turkey. It's very attractive to Turkey. The Turks want to join Europe.
Yet in the Balkans, when Serbia and Yugoslavia, that whole situation in Bosnia and then later in Kosovo, the European lack of hard power made it impossible for them to have any effect at all.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons why I say in the book that soft power is not a substitute for hard power. Soft power has to be combined with hard power in many cases to be effective. And that's what I mean when I say we're aiming not to be a soft power or a hard power, but a smart power.
Joseph Nye, again, thank you very much for being with us today. Joseph Nye's new book is Soft Power, The Means to Success in World Politics. Joseph Nye is Dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you.